Continuing, Canto 3, Chapter 15, we'll be reading verses 7, 8, 9, and 10. We're ending at 10 because that ends the section. Maitreya is speaking to Vidura. And the discussion is about why all this darkness covering the universe, and they're honoring Lord Brahma. The demigods are honoring Lord Brahma in a pretty fantastic way because he's a fantastic devotee, and they're speaking of him as the personality of Godhead in the sense that he's the representative of the personality of Godhead. So he has all these wonderful qualifications endowed by the personality of Godhead's empowering him in various ways. And the last verse that we read, text 6, O Lord, all these planets exist within yourself, and all the living entities are generated from you. Therefore, you are the cause of this universe, and anyone who meditates upon you without deviation attains devotional service. I mean, it's totally flattering. And one needs to understand this, as we discussed yesterday, not as flattery and not as they're wrong, but in terms of their understanding of Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma is their father or grandfather. Understanding his position in relation to Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, the cause of all causes, and Brahma is one of those causes. Okay, so now text 7. Demigod speaking to Lord Brahma, or praying. There is no defeat in this material world for persons who control the mind and senses by controlling the breathing process, and who are therefore experienced, mature mystics. This is because such perfection in yoga, by such perfection in yoga, they have attained your mercy. It's interesting, the previous verse they're speaking about attaining devotional service by respecting Lord Brahma in a certain way, and now they're getting this Ashtanga Yoga perfection. So, purport. The purpose of yogic performances. I'll read the verse. There is no defeat in this material world for persons who control the mind and senses by controlling the breathing process, and who therefore are experienced, mature mystics. This is because such perfection of yoga, by such perfection of yoga, they have attained your mercy. Purport. The purpose of yogic performances is explained here. It is said that an experienced mystic attains full control of the mind and senses by controlling the breathing process. Therefore, controlling the breathing process is not the ultimate aim of yoga. The real purpose of yogic performances is to control the mind and senses. Wait a minute. Controlling the mind and senses is not the purpose. The purpose is controlling the mind and senses. Anyone who has such control is understood to be an experienced, mature, mystic yogi. It is indicated herein that A yogi who has control of the mind and senses has the actual benediction of the Lord. And he has no fear. In other words, one cannot attain the mercy and benediction of the Supreme Lord until one is able to control the mind and senses. This is actually possible when one fully engages in Krishna consciousness. A person whose senses and mind are always engaged in the transcendental service of the Lord has no possibility of engaging in material activities. The devotees of the Lord are not defeated anywhere in the universe. It is stated, Narayana para sarve. One who is Narayana para, or a devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is not afraid anywhere, whether he is sent to hell or promoted to heaven. Bhagavatam 6:17-28, end of purport. Well, the demigods are afraid. And that's why they've approached Lord Brahma. But they've approached Lord Brahma because he's one who's not afraid or never defeated. And there's kind of like a sequence of it's a cultural thing, and it's also a it's part of their glorification of him. It's a continuation of their glorification. I guess this is one of those things that's necessary but not sufficient, like in mathematics. Necessary but not sufficient. Controlling the mind and senses is necessary but not sufficient to achieve the goal. The goal, well, towards what end is the mind, are the mind and senses being controlled? One who gets, so there's partial mercy, there's no mercy or minimal mercy, more mercy and full mercy. The full mercy is Lord Brahma's position, where he has realization of the personality. He has the knowledge that the personality Godhead has, because the personality God gave it to him because of Brahma's qualification. And part of his qualification is his control of his mind and senses, which is possible when one receives mercy. So, like, go the other way. Commonly, Prabhupada referred to Vishvamitra Muni and Sobri Muni, and while they were super qualified yogis, their yogic meditation was interrupted. Because they were devotees. They didn't have full shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. To do what they were doing required mercy, but they didn't have full mercy. And therefore, they could be deviated. And they were deviated. And others, Haridas Thakur and others, weren't deviated because they had the full mercy of the Supreme Lord, which was the complete dedication of their mind and senses to the Lord's service. That's the distinction, or one of the distinctions being indicated here. So it's necessary to have control of the mind and senses in order to be a recipient, to qualify for the fullness of the Lord's mercy. To do it requires mercy, it's not just one's effort. So full mercy is dedication to the service of the Lord. The purpose of the direction behind the mind and sense control. Reading the verse twice, it reminded me of the Bhagavad Gita verse, Mogasha Moga Karmano Moga Gyana Vicheta Saha, because the translation is speaking of there is no defeat in this material world for persons who control the mind and senses. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks of one is defeated when one doesn't have faith in his words. So, connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead with faith protects one from being defeated. So let's say somebody is sincere but sensually weak. What's their protection? The weakness is they're essentially weak, or even in a particular sense they have something, a bad habit or anger or some weakness, some particular spot of weakness. So what's the hope for that person to overcome the weakness? It's descending mercy. And descending mercy is received because the person is sincere. That is, they wish to connect with the personality of Godhead. Not just to get over a problem, but to connect with the personality of Godhead. I was thinking like that, a little along those lines, when I was speaking last night with the university, this Viktor Frankl thing of stress management. Well, he said it's the something like it's not necessary to be 'free from all difficulties in life, and that way I can become happy, rather that there's a higher purpose for me to be fulfilled by my mission in life. And because of that, one can overcome the difficulty. One can surpass the difficulty. His difficulty was being in a Nazi concentration camp. Our difficulty might be a little bit lighter than that, whatever the difficulty might be. So, investing in this higher purpose, the higher purpose of connecting with the personality of Godhead, sincerely, with faith, whatever the difficulty may be, that's my mission, that's my goal. Because of that, one becomes recipient of mercy, empowered, and one can either deal effectively with whatever the difficulty is, or simply transcend the difficulty, come to a higher stage of consciousness, and while tolerating the circumstance that's out of your control to change, being fixed in Krishna consciousness. So that's like, you know, the ultimate higher mission, which is the message of the Bhagavatam, not just getting out of the Nazi concentration camp, or not even just getting out of the material world, but being in a relationship with the personality of Godhead as a mission, and, you know, some particular service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, serving him in some way that's pleasing to him and his devotees as a mission to connect with, that allows something that's in this case that the demigods seeing darkest in the universe, and they understand this is a bad omen. What's the cause of the bad omen? What's going on here? So they've described, you know the cause because you know everything. So please, what's the cause? And now this verse is, there is no defeat in this material world for persons who control the mind and senses. Now there's continuing by controlling the breathing process. So the controlling the breathing process is a mechanical process that by mechanical means permits a peaceful mind, a strengthened mind, a concentrated mind, very, very powerful mind, which can then control the senses. But that's it's just staying on the mechanical platform it's negation. The roar of the mind and the clamor of the senses subsides, and one can feel somewhat peaceful in that condition. But what's going to hold that in place without actual shelter is not going to hold in place. There's some attraction for that peacefulness that represents a slackening or a removal of the noise and the clamor. But there's something missing. There's something that's missing is the happiness and joy of a loving relationship, ultimately loving relationship with the personality of God. And so it's not enduring. It's not sustainable. Therefore, even to do that requires mercy, and to go the whole distance where it's unchangeable, unshakable, that requires the extra, the commitment of the mind and senses fully to Krishna's service, which is what Prabhupada is saying in the purport, the Narayana Para verse. The Narayana Para verse, you know this one. This is Lord Shiva speaking to Parvati about the qualification of King Chitraketu. He was so exalted because he was a Narayana Para, an unflinching devotee of Narayana. And because of that, he remained undisturbed. This is a common term and a common concept in Vedic wisdom. Dhira, Dhiras Tatra Namuyati in the Upanishads, Ishopanishads. Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. One who is Dhira is one who is undisturbed, even when there's cause of disturbance. Sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. That's possible. One is not disturbed or defeated when their consciousness is fixed on the personality of Godhead. When they have shelter and they feel protection, they can't be defeated, they remain undisturbed. One, on the other hand, who may be strong because of penances or austerities or physical strength or power or whatever it is that they've got going for themselves, they may feel overconfident. But they're defeated. Ultimately, they're defeated by death. They're defeated by the laws of nature. But for a devotee, that the Bhagavatam verse that says, for one who's a devotee, their time is, for one who's not a devotee, time passing is simply bringing them closer to death. But for a devotee, time passing is simply bringing them closer to eternal life. There's different ways of beautifully describing the same thing. Real shelter in the personality of Godhead is a position of fearlessness. It's a position where one cannot be defeated. Even if some reversal comes, using Prabhupada's language, that's not a sign of defeat. It's some opportunity given by the devotee, understands, and it's true, circumstance given by Krishna to take further shelter of Krishna. Like Maharaj Parikshit being cursed. He took it, the Lord is so kind, he's taking away my attachment to material circumstance and being a king and family and stuff, too attached. So he's very kind. He's taking that attachment away, amplified by fear. He knows that I couldn't let go of it myself except for fear, so now he's giving me this good medicine. A transcendentalist not only can think that way, a transcendentalist thinks that way because they have full shelter. The converse is, one who doesn't have full shelter, they're fearful. They're in anxiety. They appear to be, at least, defeated. Let's cover the remaining few verses and finish the section. Text number 8. All the living entities within the universe are conducted by Vedic directions, as a bull is directed by the rope attached to its nose. No one can violate the rules laid down by the Vedic literatures. To the chief person who has contributed the Vedas, we offer our respect. This metaphor of the bull with a rope through his nose, sometimes it's a moon with rope tied to the ring through his nose, is used many times in the Bhagavatam, indicating the voluntary submission of a Vedic follower to the codes of the Vedas. The codes of the Vedas are like the rope, and who's on the other side of the rope? The personality of Godhead. He's controlling through those injunctions, the do's and the don'ts, dharma. One who's controlled by dharma and protects dharma is protected by dharma, which means protected by the personality of Godhead. Same message as one can't be defeated. Who can challenge the personality of Godhead and defeat him? Purport. The Vedic literatures are the laws of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One cannot violate the injunctions given in the Vedic literatures any more than one can violate the state laws. Of course, people violate both. That means you can't without getting punishment. Any living creature who wants real benefit in life must act according to the directions of the Vedic literature. The conditioned souls who have come to this material world for material sense gratification are regulated by the injunctions of the Vedic literature. Sense gratification is just like salt. One cannot take too much or too little, but one must take some salt in order to make one's foodstuff palatable. Those conditioned souls who have come to this material world should utilize their senses according to the directions of the Vedic literature. Otherwise, so they can deviate, then they will be put into a more miserable condition of life. No human being or demigod can enact laws like those of the Vedic literature because the Vedic regulations are prescribed by the Supreme Lord. So if you don't accept the authority of the Supreme Lord and you're trying to figure out, like this question of, you know, ethics and morality in God thing. Okay, let's make up some morals and some ethics. Or, you know, generations or centuries or cultures of people have their standards. And then, you know, that's all we need. Why do we need God? It's one of the things that fascinates me about China. God isn't in the picture. Right? Well, you know, the whole communism, God isn't in the picture. God is the opiate of the people. So, what's to control the mind and senses of the people? You know, what keeps law and order in China? It's fear. And how long can you run a government on fear? You know, North Korea. How long can you... history shows it's not enduring. And the whole history of China. I don't know the history so well, but there's like all these wars going on all the time. You know, this group and that group. Somebody comes to power and then they're... it's the same program. Then somebody's... it's why the government is really... tight about anybody that's against the government, snuff them out. it's like Stalin, you know, it's now how long is that sustainable? Besides, you know, is it, whether it's human or not, is it sustainable? But then comes this other thing, you know, that people worry about and complain about. As soon as you bring God in, then you got different groups of people saying God is like this, and another group says he's like that, and then they start clashing with one another over which is the right picture of God. So you bring God into the picture, but you have to keep going. You have to take them to the position of realization. So it has to be a genuine something, not the other kind. And that's a challenge, especially in Kali Yuga. Where are you going to find something genuine, and how are you going to get people ready to go to the goal line? They like, you know, they get a little relieved of their distresses, and in comes complacency. And then speculation, and here in comes some deviations. You get a powerful guy over in the deviation side, and, you know, it's a mess. So problems are abundant, and the solution is Krishna consciousness, and there isn't another solution. You can try to control the problem in methods that make it look like, okay, it's under control, at least a little bit, but it's not under control. Without Krishna consciousness, there isn't a solution. So, to help one get there, there are these codes of the Vedas, and they're to be followed by everybody. You know, the Varnashram system, people are to follow. But the purpose of the Varnashram system is also not just you follow your Varna, you follow your ashram, and, you know, you go to the good place instead of the bad place. The goal is ending the cycle of birth and death and achieving perfection. So daily Varnashram is needed. Commitment to the personality of Godhead. So the demigods are very elevated. They recognize that Lord Brahma has qualifications beyond their qualifications, and therefore they're seeking his protection. To the chief person who has contributed the Vedas, we offer our respect. They're honoring Lord Brahma. Two more verses. The demigods pray to Brahma, please look upon us mercifully who have fallen into a miserable condition because of darkness. All our work has been suspended. We can't do our service. Please turn on the light. Or why is this darkness? Purport. Because of complete darkness throughout the universe, the regular activities and engagements of all the different planets were suspended. In the north and south poles of this planet, there are sometimes no divisions of day and night. Similarly, when the sunlight does not approach the different planets within the universe, there is no distinction between day and night. And the final text, 10. As fuel overloads a fire, so the embryo created by the semen of Kasyapa in the womb of Diti has caused complete darkness throughout the universe. One sentence purport. The darkness throughout the universe is explained herewith as being caused by the embryo created in the womb of Diti by the semen of Kashyapa. So, we ended the other morning with Brahma saying, I've explained to you now the answer to your question, why this darkness. Now you know the detail of the darkness and how, you know, the whole history behind how the Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu took birth in the womb of Diti, falling from the position of Jayant Vijay and the curse of the Kumaras and the whole story. But that's all part of the plan, and the Lord's going to come and deal with the situation, so What's your problem? It's out of your hand. It's something the Lord has ordained. It's out of your hand. So let it go, and the Lord will personally come and address the situation. But inauspiciousness for more than just, you know, the mother and father can exist when there's demoniac persons who are within the womb of the mother or born in the world. It certainly causes pain and trouble for the mother and father. But it causes trouble for the whole universe. And then the converse is also true. Again, using Prabhupada's language, by producing God-conscious children, it's not only beneficial and pleasing for the mother and father, but it's uplifting for the whole society by the presence of qualified persons, qualified souls. Everyone becomes benefited. There's the fruit of divine and there's the fruit of demoniac culture. And it starts, you know, with an individual. And then it spreads, you know, collectively and societally and broader and broader. Okay, so any discussion?
This is from yesterday's section. In the beginning, you were reading how quality of deity, specifically mentioned lamentation, which actually allowed her to get the benediction of having grandson as Prahlad Maharaj. Generally, like I have heard from you as well as from other sources that regret is what is considered to be preferable to lamenting. I'm just clarifying whether this lamentation is used in that sense, that it's actually meant to be like a regret.
I'm looking for the exact reference so that we say it properly or discuss it properly.
Chapter.
I'm looking at the end of the 14th chapter. Okay. Two things, at least, you know, from what you describe, it's not because of her lamentation she got a benediction. Like, this is the cause and that's the effect. So all we have to do is lament, like Diti lamented, and then we'll get some benediction. So it's not a cause-effect thing. That's one comment. And the answer to your question is yes. It's in the sense of regret. She had an impure, in many ways impure desire that she acted on. And the consequences were profoundly horrible. And she had deep regret. What I recall reading was she was being pacified in hearing that the grandson would be very special. So she felt joy knowing the grandson would be very special. Okay. Is that?
Yes.
Anything else?
Guru Maharaj, on the topic of God ethics, morality.
God ethics?
God ethics and morality.
Okay.
On the topic.
Yeah.
Someone may say that why do we need a personal God as an absolute reference? Why not an impersonal set of absolute principles that we all agree upon?
Well, two answers. That's just not the way it is. Just not the way it is. You know, it's not a matter of, you know, if you've got a menu, you will select from the menu. There's a way it is, and the way it is there's a person. And then another is principles are upheld by a person. Modern, you know, say mechanistic science, what has helped us to make a leap of faith into the idea that there's a possibility of laws of nature that just are there, mm-hmm. and there's no person behind the laws that created the laws and uphold the laws. They're just there. But when you step back, is that logical? Is there ever a system? No. So there's a person behind the laws that create the laws and uphold the laws. That's sensible. And as above, so below. So we find there's laws that are upheld by people, created by people. So by inference, that's the way it is. And by reality, that's the way it is. It's just that's the way it is. God is a person. And so that's, you know, here's another. What's the goal? Where, with that notion, where are we headed? And who are we today? And what's the goal of, what's the ultimate outcome or fruition of that notion? It's meaninglessness. Everything starts from nothing and it ends up in nothing. And so in between, what do we have? We have nothing. But that's not very attractive. When you really consider what's being said and the implication of it. But why is it that we want relationships? It's intrinsic to who we are. It's natural. So the ultimate reality is a natural reality. It's not this other one. The picture is an unnatural, unreal picture. It just doesn't match. And then, then back to the first one. There's the authority of the scripture. God is a person. Well, my reading is God's not a person. And then you have that standoff. But it's aham, first person singular. Since when is aham not person?
Just to follow up to that, so from what I'm seeing is the most recent argument that, say, a scientist gives us. He says basically, see, I'm not an atheist, but I'm agnostic. Like I was watching a debate between a Christian priest and atheistic philosopher, agnostic. And the moderator poses a question to both of them, and the Christian priest goes on to say, this is God, he's like this, blah blah blah. And then goes to the agnostic and he simply says, I don't know. And hundreds of people sitting in the audience, they just give him a standing ovation. Because it seems like people are comfortable when someone says, or they think they're being honest when they say, I don't know, we're just saying this is it. So sometimes I find it challenging when I'm conveying the message that this is it according to this tradition or this scripture.
How you feel and how they feel don't necessarily have to coincide.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, I'm saying so on the authority of Praman. So you're not accepting Praman, and so you don't know. And I'm accepting Praman, and I know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as far as modern intellectual political correctness is concerned, that's fine. You have your perspective. You're not imposing your perspective on others. That's a no-no. But you have your perspective. And that's that's fine. And, people in the audience, they can feel comfortable that they have their perspective too. Could be a third thing. I know that there isn't God. I don't know. And I know that there is God. I'm the authority of Pramat. And here's my reason why I accept Praman, Shabda Praman, and then said of the other kind. By sense, perception, and reason, I don't know. That's honest. It's something like the discussion that you've heard me describe this probably a number of times. When I was a senior in high school, we had a Japanese student stay in our home, and he did his senior year with me. He stayed in this room, I stayed in that room, So, he went on to get his 3 PhDs.
Mm.
And he was studying, the division of a frog cell into two cells, and how it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I posed a question. What if, behind this cell division, there was some spiritual principle that gave life to this other cell? And he said, I don't know. We can't even talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
So as a scientist, we can't even talk about it. It may be, it may not be. We can't even, enter into discussion about it. So, that's honest. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
By sense and reason, you don't know. It just doesn't enter into that territory. Is there a way to know? Yes, and what's that way? Shabda Praman. Oh, come on. That's faith. And to that we say, well, you have faith in your mind and senses to do your experiment. Your senses are imperfect and your reasoning makes mistakes. So, yet you're going down that path. So you also don't know. But you have faith in your senses and your reasoning capacity. Somebody else could look at the same data and come up with a different conclusion. There's a different lens,
mm-hmm.
different reasoning filter. And science shows that over and over and over again, what I just said. So over and over and over again. And you can't, how are you going to free yourself from a predisposition of what lens you're going to choose to look at it through? So you don't, so you can say, I don't know, and from my perspective, you also don't know, but you say that you know. Because that's the lens you're looking through. And I'm saying, I know, and you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And can't know, because you're not accepting this pramana.
System of knowledge. Mm.
And so it's a standoff. for these from, you know, from a neutral judge, perhaps it's a standoff. And then it's a little bit, again, it's like Professor Stahl correspondence. Prabhupada and Professor Stahl, and Professor Stahl saying Brahman, Prabhupada saying person. In the end, you know, it was a stalemate. But you read carefully in Prabhupada's, it's very strong. It was so important. Prabhupada had a separate publication made of that correspondence with Professor Stahl. So let the impartial person evaluate. And their evaluation is going to depend upon the lens they choose to look at the discussion. Mm. All that you can do in situations like that, when you're like, you know, with discriminating persons, is don't be dogmatic. Like that was, you know, the question of spirituality and religion. Religion that's dogmatic, everyone goes, boo, bad. So don't be dogmatic. You're just, you know, in a non-judgmental way, this is my position. This is why I've taken my position. What spirituality means is, and it doesn't mean that. That's my definition of terms. And my reason for that is Shabda Praman. Mm-hmm. That's my anchor. That's my shelter. That's my means of knowing things. Mm-hmm. And let's go over to look at your means of knowing things. Guaranteed it's flawed. Over here, it's flawed if the source is fallible. But if the source is infallible, it's guaranteed to be right. So take a pick. Well, I can't go there. I can't put my faith in. Okay. That's a choice that you make. But I prefer this choice, and here's why. Mm. But anyway, I'm not judging and imposing, and but this is why. And it, you know, in many cases, my observation is like this kind of, you know, debate kind of thing, where someone is very reasonable and they're not dogmatic. It's, you know, that wins the favor of the audience. Whereas this looks like dogma and this looks like reasonable, so he gets the vote, mm-hmm. standing ovation. Mm-hmm. But the person that's making the presentation can be very reasonable, besides dogmatic. And the goal is not, you know, winning the vote either. The goal is touching the hearts of people that are searching for truth. So then one can make strong statements too, and it's not, you know, doesn't lose points with persons who are searching for truth. Just mm-hmm. one can make points clearly and strongly. But tarka apratishta. The truth can't be established by reason and logic. But when one needs to be, you know, aesthetically appearing to be very reasonable. Mm. Because persons who have the truth, let's say, you know, one who has received descending transcendental knowledge, and their method is abrasive, and their personality is obnoxious, people don't pay attention to that. Mm. So they have to have Vaishnavachar along with proper prachar. Then it's compelling. Mm. And then some people can say, well, I like this one more than that one. Okay.
Yeah. When talking about controlling the mind and senses,
yeah.
So when one person does something without the control of mind and senses, and can we relate that to faith? So what is
sure.
faith?
Faith. F-A-T-E.
Yeah.
Faith. No. If there's some impelling force, let's say someone's an alcoholic, or they were an alcoholic and they went through a recovery program and now they're sober and they're going along, and you know, somebody who's, something happens and they're put in touch with the opportunity to take alcohol again, and due to sensual weakness they take alcohol again. Was it fated that that happened? No. It's a choice. There's many choices back there that caused that propensity, because another person, it's not an issue at all. It's an issue for that person because of previous choices. But so the previous choices create a circumstance. Not like it was fated that they would make those previous choices, so they'd be in this position of weakness and then they fall prey to that weakness by the circumstance. It's not fate. What's fated is, because of my past choices, here I am in a circumstance that's confronting me. And now, because I'm in a weak condition, I may fall prey to this weakness, this bad habit. I'll say the same thing in a different way. Prabhupada was once asked, if there's a flu going around, or some illness, and one person gets the flu, the other person doesn't get the flu, is that destiny? Is that their karma? One gets, the other doesn't get. Prabhupada's answer wasn't a yes or no answer. He said, when one's resistance is low, one will contract the disease. When resistance is strong, one will not contract the disease.
So the resistance depends upon?
In terms of Krishna consciousness, how you have taken shelter of the internal potency. When you're protected or sheltered by the internal potency, the external potency can't touch you. Mind and sense control are already in your hand, because there's this free will choice to be situated in the internal potency, and you're protected, you're under the guidance of the internal potency, because we're going to be under the jurisdiction of one or the other, because we're marginal, this one or that one, and it's a choice that we have to make. I choose the internal potency, that's my resistance is strong, and I'm protected from this disease, the disease called Kali Yuga, and you know, television, and you know, meat eating and stuff, whatever other, you know, the symptoms of the disease of Kali Yuga. I'm protected from it because I'm in this, I don't use my mind and senses in those ways. I only use them in Krishna service. That's it. And then the otherwise is no. So there's protection. Resistance is strong. Yeah.
Guru Maharaj, you were talking about controlling of mind and senses today.
Yeah.
What of certain people or children who are born with diminished senses and diminished mind? Like, you know, someone is paralyzed or can't hear, can't see, different kind of, you know, diminution, limitations on their...
What about them?
Yeah, so
what's your question?
Yeah, so how are they going to access the full shelter, and what means to be controlling mind and senses for them?
Say the last part again, because I could talk on the topic, but I want to answer your question.
How are they going to take shelter of Krishna?
By hearing.
And
supposing the hearing is defective, it works anyways. Their capacity is diminished because of their past free will choices. They've been the faculty may be impaired or diminished or even apparently not even functioning. They broke the instrument because of the past free will choices they made. But still it acts. So, you know, besides a human, there's a plant in your house. You know, like that tree that's in the Chicago Temple room? Man, What a lucky soul. Yeah, I think about, you know, it's been there for years and years and years, and all those kirtans and everything. How fortunate. So, that's, you know, there's great misfortune. He can't, like, play mridanga and kartal and dance, but he can be present in the kirtan. So, some impaired person may also. But how are they going to be benefited by spiritual sound vibration that acts, you know, even if the instrument is broken, the sense instrument?
So what would mean for them to control their senses and their mind? Like,
through spiritual sound. I've seen, you know, I don't know what the right word is, but children that are impaired. And as soon as they're kirtan, they light up. They say, you know, move their arms like, you know, they're in kirtan. The kirtan is over, and then they start making different noises, you know, and you know that's their connection to sound vibration. So it's you know the rate at which the tree in the temple room in Chicago and the sense impaired, you know, person is going to be limited because of their, you know, the wet wood is still wet ruin. It can't, it's not dry yet. It can't be ignited. But they can benefit. That's the advantage of spiritual sound vibration. It acts on everybody, all souls. And the way in which we can benefit from that is, you know, depending upon the faculties that we have.
So they can still perfect their life.
Yeah.
In this life.
Yeah.
And yeah. What are the parents to do to, you know, like just put a sound vibration environment?
In the Boston Temple, when it was in Alston on North Beacon Street, behind the temple, it was like this rented house and the other, there was a fence, and on the other side of the fence, there was one of those persons, mm-hmm. in a wheelchair, and he, you know, kind of, you know, his head tilted, and his whole facial features were not normal, but he was very attracted. Now, inside, something was there that attracted him, and he wanted to come. So the person attending, and he was there at all, you know, and up a flight of stairs. So they had to take him out of his chair. And so he was very attracted to Krishna consciousness. And you know, I don't know how Krishna looked upon him and his Krishna consciousness, but my sense is Krishna was smiling on him and his Krishna consciousness because despite the impairment, he was very clearly attracted. I was thinking, you know, I should be so attractive as he is. Then I, you know, he'd be a wonderful devotee. I don't know, but, you know, when he would speak, it was this kind of sound. But, you know, something was registering and he was trying to express it. So, I can't say for sure, you know, what his destination will be or is by now. It's probably gone, but it's certainly a better situation, if not, you know, with Krishna, because of that attraction for Krishna. And, you know, each impaired person, their condition is different, but the principle is the same, attraction for Krishna through sound.